Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we have a health topic for you, something that we do periodically throughout the year. We will be talking about skin and skin care, and our guest for the program is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic in Champaign, one of a group, I think, three still that take turns being here on the program to answer questions, and that's what we will do. Now, whenever we have a doctor here on the program, particularly something like this, I always say at the beginning, remember, we cannot do a diagnosis over the phone because the doctor can't see you, and particularly, I think when we're talking about skin, it's difficult when you can't see what the person is talking about. Yeah. But, of course, we keep doing these programs because we think it's a good source of information for people who are listening. So I always say that at the beginning. I don't want to discourage anyone from calling, but just so people can appreciate that.
Great. Thanks. As they say on Iron Chef, I'll do my best.
We rely on that. Thank you very much. Well, we appreciate you being here.
Great. Thank you.
Let me give the phone numbers. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. It's summer, and I am sure that you would like the opportunity, on behalf of all the dermatologists in the United States, to remind people again about sun exposure and wear your sunscreen.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, and it's like every other boring topic, it's got a lot more complications than that. It's sunscreen, don't be out in the middle of the day, wear appropriate clothing, but certainly don't get sunburned.
And this is, you know, we do these shows and we do these shows in the summer and the winter. And I think we probably particularly make a point of this in the summer because people will be out more and they're exposing more of themselves. But in truth, I think the advice is that you also should think about that in the wintertime as well. And the recommendation, I suppose, is that if you're going to be outside, you should wear a sunscreen summer and winter.
Right. Even around here, although it's nicest to sort of keep the habit up. Uh-huh. Philosophically, for sure. Obviously, if you're going to be out for a long period of time, even around here, it makes a difference. And of course, if you're going skiing outdoors, elevation, those also make a difference.
Right. So you want to particularly be concerned about the peak hours of when the sun is most directly overhead.
Right.
Say 2 to 4 or something like that. Something like that.
Yeah, 11 to 3, yeah, 11, whatever.
Yeah.
Certainly.
But at all other times too, even if you're just going to be out cutting the grass or whatever, it'd probably be a good idea.
Right. Yeah. Right. You can get a pretty significant amount of sun before and after that. The B rays, the ultraviolet B, which is the big problem for causing skin cancer, is at those peak hours because it will be deflected and absorbed by ozone as it comes through when the sun's at a lower angle.
Yeah. Do you – there are now some manufacturers of clothing that make, you know, shirts and shorts and
right.
stuff like that
right.
that have some UV blocking
right.
capability. Do
and
those things actually work?
They're fabulous. Yeah, you can run an SPF test on them and they'll be in the 100-plus range. So they block out about all the UV light. So if you take a nice white cotton T-shirt and you put it on somebody and say, go ahead and swim now, Timmy. That's got an SPF of about 2 once it gets wet. But these, I was gratified. I was down in the ocean this wintertime, and there were lots of youngish kids who had on these little bathing costume sorts, and I'd not seen that before.
Okay. We have a caller here. Maybe either we need to get you closer to the mic
okay,
or the mic
sure,
here closer.
Sure, that's fine.
Very good. We have a caller here, line number one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. I have a 3-month-old, and sun protection stuff says don't put on before 6 months old. What's your opinion on that? And is there a way we could test them for sensitivity? Or, you know, we don't put them in the sun very often, but even just driving around in the car sometimes, even with screens, he seems to get some sun exposure.
Right. You know, I don't know the whole genesis of the not before 6 months. I suspect that no responsible parent would be very excited about saying, let's put sunscreen on your, you know, 4-month-old and we'll do some blood tests to see if they've absorbed a significant amount of chemicals.
Right.
And indeed, young children have a much more permeable skin barrier, so okay. more things can get through than normal skin. There, in that context, though, there are two significant category differences in sunblocks. There are the ones that use UV-absorbing chemicals with names like oxy, methoxy, cinnamate, and
right.
all those.
Right, I'm allergic to all those, and right. so we don't use those on our older kid even.
Right. So, but the barrier sunblocks, which are basically titanium oxide and zinc oxide, those are in all the diaper creams or in, you know, white paint, and they function by reflecting the light back off.
Uh-huh.
So Neutrogena Chemical Free is one of the brands.
That's what we use on our three-year-old.
Right. So basically that is a moisturizer kind of base with something which is a particulate and simply can't absorb through a six-month-old skin. So theoretically there's really no reason to put it on a six-month-old.
Okay.
Or under six.
Or even under six.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, the other question.
I hate to go against guidelines and all that
stuff. It's similar to, like, other medications where they say, okay, don't use it under 6 years old without consent of a doctor.
Right, right.
So what's the doctor supposed to figure out?
Well, exactly, and we're generally not doing big, broad statistical studies and all
right,
that, but
they're
basically shifting responsibility, which is okay because – but you can be sensible, for goodness sake, and there's no way that titanium or zinc dioxide are going to hurt somebody.
Well, okay, so I might just do, like, the skin test thing, but I think he's going to be fine with it.
Right. Put it on a small area, make sure he doesn't
get
irritated.
Yeah, small area. Okay,
no eyes, by the way.
Right, oh, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other question with regard to, you know, as a female, we have baseline screenings for like breast cancer and stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
What's the recommended age for baseline screening of skin cancer, and do doctors tend to do those on a regular basis? I mean, do they just kind of, well, until you have a problem, I'll see you, or is there something else that's recommended along those lines?
You know, the reality is it depends lots on family history and individual variations. So if you have a big family history of lots of people with skin cancer or you're extremely pale in pigmentation, those are those two things put you at more risk. The more pigment you have, the less likely you are to have skin cancer on a statistical basis. So I like to see people who've got lots of funny-looking moles. I like to see them, you know, when they're 18, if grandma and an uncle have had a melanoma,
that
screening should become young. But that's for melanoma.
Okay.
But then the truly sun-exposed skin kind of cancers, the basals and squamous cell carcinomas, that's generally the sort of thing that we would start screening later.
Okay.
But how do you know in advance if you're going to get what kind of skin cancer you might get?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, my husband's the one I'm thinking about because he's very pale, and his father has had a few lesions removed most recently. And, you know, I just remember that back when no one used sunscreens, number one, and, you know, kids were generally just allowed to run around with, you know, T-shirts and shorts, and they got sunburned. Well, they got sunburned, and it was not a big deal. And now it's, you know, now it's coming to haunt.
Right.
And so I just wondered if there was a way to, you know, somehow have an exam done where they can take kind of an inventory of how all his moles, and then, you know, maybe have an update on a yearly or twice, or, you know, every other year or something like that.
You're exactly right. And that dermatologists do all that all the time. And some primary care physicians are very observant and responsible about this. And, you know, you rely on them to do an exam and refer or biopsy as appropriate.
Okay, but there's no standard age that's recommended or anything like that? It's depending on family history?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And certainly, you know, at 50 is an easy guideline to...
Okay. All right, great.
But younger with family history, younger with significant sunburns in the past, because, you know, we see this at all age groups now.
Okay, and one last question, I'll hang up. It's just like, okay, so I'm getting, at my age, I'm over 40, I'm getting molds moles coming out. You know, they just all of a sudden one morning they're there. What's the genesis for these things? I mean, I'm just curious as to all of a sudden it seems like one is there and right. where it wasn't before. And so I don't know. They're pretty harmless looking. They're not like weird shaped or anything like that. But I just really wondered how they form and why they come out at a certain point in time, especially as we get older.
Sure.
And I'll hang up and just listen.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, on that question, there are basically, again, it's hard to say, moles, the kind of thing that are related to pigment cells that pop up that everybody would agree is a mole, those tend also to be genetically encoded but stimulated more by early childhood sun exposure and sunburns. So those just do sort of accumulate as time goes on. They're generally not quite so explosive. Gosh, they weren't there yesterday. Now I've got 500. Freckly things that some people come to me and say they're moles. They're just pigmentary spots, and that's just sort of overstimulated pigment cells. Those just show up as time goes on. They don't generally want to go away either. And there's another entity called keratoses, and they're just sort of little warty growths, and they're very, very common. And they do come on with time, family history. So it's complicated, complicated situation. Some data were presented a while ago. They said for every melanoma that you see, there are 200,000 benign skin growths. And I'd seen 40 melanomas the year before, so I asked this fellow, do you mean I've seen 8 million benign skin growths in the last year? And he stuck with his number, and he said, yeah, you probably did. So, yeah, you know, you obviously don't linger on each one because life goes on.
All right. Well, again, we have plenty of time for questions about skin. Can have to do with sun exposure or anything else. If you call in and you would like to talk with our guest, Dr. Lester Farner, he's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just real quick, when we're talking about routine screening that you might be doing, is that, are we simply talking about having the person, you know, take their clothes off and stand there in front of you, so, and you're just looking to see if anything that right away you see something?
Right. I mean that's the ultimate at its sort of most basic. That's, you know, say, well, let me take a look. We obviously can't do that on the radio, but there is another way of going about it, which is in evolution right now. And, it, you know, do you take total body photographs of somebody? Mm-hmm. Do you make Kodachromes or prints? Who stores them? Does the patient keep them? Do you compare them, you know, stand them up to a slide screen and project, or do they bring in their previously made photographs? Does insurance pay for the photographs? All that. There are also computer programs now which will do this digitally mm-hmm. and store them and go through that. So, I don't think anybody in town has adopted that at this point. You can refer people out for those sorts of things. And I don't know that, you know, it can be helpful, but we haven't yet figured out what's the proper standard of care on that.
And I think that one of the things that I know people who are concerned with skin and skin cancer and so forth, their concern is that we're starting to see skin cancer in people who are younger than perhaps we had seen it before, at least if we're talking about people who, lifeguards,
right.
People who spent a lot of time outside, or perhaps people who in a very deliberate way spent time outside because they
sure.
wanted to be.
Or inside in a tanning bed.
Or inside in a tanning bed. Is there at some point where you think that the recommendation for when you really start to be concerned about this, instead of it being 50,
oh, yeah.
is it going to be 30 or 25?
Believe me, I you know, don't hold me to the 50. I see plenty of people who are 40, and I see them routinely. It's based on sort of what kind of moles they have, what mm-hmm. their, you know, what their own prior history is, whether they've had a biopsies done, those sorts of mm-hmm. issues.
All right, so okay, so if you have a person, say you have a person, so average kind of skin tone,
yeah.
a person who had, say, what you would call average kind of sun exposure,
right.
not someone who had been a sun worshiper, not someone who had been working outside,
right.
not someone who had spent a lot of time in a tanning bed,
right.
would it be safe to say that you would think that, say, before age 50, you're not likely to see a lot of problems? I mean, is there some kind of line at which you would say after, here's the point at which I want you to be, start to be really concerned.
No, it's a curve. It's a very gentle curve. There's no abrupt step where I say, okay, you're safe before 50.
Okay.
You know, not at all.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with Sarah Gordo, line number one.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I was diagnosed with psoriasis about 5 years ago, and the dermatologist gave me a three topical ointments to apply to those lesions or spots, primarily on my arms, and it worked quite well, but I didn't like the way I felt after I used that product. And so I let it go, and I've used a lot of natural things like clay, and I found that exposure to salt water sometimes helped it, but pretty much I've let it go, and now it's primarily on my lower legs. Is there a problem with letting that condition continue, or should it really be treated?
Very nice question. If it's limited psoriasis, limited locations, and treating it with moisturizers and whatever other sorts of things you do, really should be fine. If you're not concerned about it cosmetically, it doesn't itch too much, doesn't cause you a lot of trouble, it really shouldn't be an issue. There's evidence that the people who have more, there's an entity called psoriatic arthritis, and it's an arthritis much like rheumatoid arthritis that we see in people with psoriasis. And sometimes that arthritis will come on before the psoriasis makes its appearance. It is linked loosely with the more psoriasis you have, the more likely you are to have psoriatic arthritis. But I don't think that there's any evidence that, let's say we treated you aggressively with whatever, you know, standard medical approach we could pick. I don't know that there's any evidence that would prevent you from someday developing psoriatic arthritis. It just would make it perhaps okay, I'm going to stop that sentence and now start another one. If you have a lots of extensive psoriasis that's been untreated, it's a little harder to treat it with topicals. So if you've got limited distribution, it's okay to leave it alone. But if you've got lots, you'd want to have it more likely to be aggressive. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Ellsworth. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have skin tags.
Sure.
And I don't know exactly what they are, and my doctor said that they could be removed, but they also seem to like pop up randomly.
Sure.
Can you explain to me kind of like what they are and what having them removed would involve?
Right. Where are they located on you?
Around my neck.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very typical location. You know, skin tags are little tiny injections. Sometimes they start little. They can grow a little bit bigger. And they're completely normal skin biologically. But it's supposed to lie flat and sort of, you know, be next to its neighbors. But generally they are caused by friction and rubbing. So we see them in flexural folds. We see them on necks from collars, underarms from, you know, the rubbing of your arm against your trunk, inner thighs, places like that. And it just makes it stick out instead of lying flat. So they grow out and they get these little tiny tag-like things. They are benign. They stay benign. They're kind of a nuisance. They get snagged on things occasionally. And removal is generally done three ways. You can physically remove them with a little sterile scissors, just sort of snip them off and do whatever you need to stop the little spot of blood. You can use an electric cautery device, which sends a little electric current into them. You set it to the right level. And then they sort of, the heat created by that device cooks them off. And if you have liquid nitrogen, you can freeze them off and they'll just swell up and fall off the same as we treat warts. And depending on the numbers and the location and the size, or whatever's handy also, you know, we treat them that way.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So it's really not, it's the kind of thing where whether you treat them, not treat them, that's kind of up to you?
Yes. Yeah, because, I mean, occasionally they're on a little relatively narrow stalk. So sometimes the stalk will get kinked over and cut off the blood supply, and then you've got this tender tissue that's been oxygen and nutrient deprived. So then it swells up and it hurts and all that. But, you know, that happens one out of several thousand tags. So then another new issue comes up with who's going to pay for it, because the insurance companies say, well, you can keep those. It's not part of your general health screening, so you better pay your doctor yourself. And then that becomes an issue and all that.
Hmm.
Okay. Welcome to America.
Well, again, I hope that answers the question of the caller. Is that something that is is a family doctor, a family practice doctor, something
yeah, could
absolutely.
Do? Absolutely.
So it's not necessary. You wouldn't necessarily have to go to see a dermatologist
Correct.
To do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. They're very straightforward in the diagnosis, and they're not a big challenge.
All right. Line 3 is next. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thank you for visiting.
Mm-hmm.
I have ichthyosis. I've had it since childhood, and I wonder if there's been any recent developments. And by recent, I mean since 1956. Well, when I was a very young child, they put me on steroids. I guess it was pretty severe. And since then, I've only treated it with Vaseline or, you know, oily type products.
Yes.
And I wondered if there might be some sort of internal medicine or something topical that's, you know, prescription only.
Sure. Now, ichthyosis is sort of a family of diseases, and it's dry, plate-like scale.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have the kind that gets much better, you know, considerably better in the summer and worse in the dry, harsh, cold winter?
Yes.
Okay. And it's generally spares your neck and your folds?
No, I don't have it on my neck, and I don't have it on my arms where, you know, it rubs against my body, and
Right.
I don't have it on my inner thigh.
Exactly. So, and is it symptomatically troublesome, or is it just sort of the way it looks and...
Well, in the winter, it is very troublesome.
Okay. This is the commonest form of ichthyosis. And, gosh, since 1956, there are a couple things. And one, they're both non-prescription, and neither of them are internal. So it's mm-hmm. you're sort of committed to putting on a lot of lotion.
Mm-hmm.
There's something you can buy without a prescription called amylactin lotion, which has... 12% lactic acid, the same sort of acid that makes yogurt tangy.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps absorb some moisture and hold it into your skin if used long term. And I say long term, it's one of those things that's like doing sit-ups. You know, you got to keep after them or you get a little soft.
Mm-hmm.
And but it'll take away some of the branny dry scale and make you itch less. That's pretty straightforward because that's available in a, you know, sort of a generic-y equivalent without a prescription in most of the stores around.
Okay.
And there's another more elegant and scientifically correct product called PDS, which just is short for problem dry skin, that was developed by a San Francisco dermatologist.
Could you spell it?
PDS, just the 3 letters.
Oh, PDS.
Yes,
okay.
I'm sorry. And I've got an 800 number that you could call my office and get this afternoon.
Okay.
Where you can order it. And it actually does a very, very nice job.
Okay.
It's more expensive and, you know, you have to go through the effort of getting it. But mm-hmm. It's a nice product.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're midway through already. And our guest is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. We're talking about skin. That's his special area of practice. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone listening, obviously, on the internet. They're in Houston, Texas. Line number 4 here. Toll free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I have a question on the aging spot. I hope it's not auto question. You know, is that aging spot is related to sun?
Where's the spot located, ma'am?
On the hands?
Yeah. Yeah, those spots are directly related to sun. They're simply areas of pigment cells that in the past, on exposure to ultraviolet light, they thought that it was their job to make some pigment to help protect your skin. And they've simply become sort of minor overachievers there. They say, oh, let's make lots of pigment. That's what she asked us to do. So they are quite common. Sometimes people really don't like them because they do indeed reflect both sun exposure and age.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to get them off.
So there's no way to get rid of it.
Oh, no. Yes, there is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there
oh.
are ways to get rid of them. Two major ways. Well, number one, the foundation is going to be that you're going to have to wear sunblock on them all the time because you don't want to re-stimulate them.
Okay.
But there are some creams that will help lighten them up. You can do some chemical peels, a series of chemical peels, or you can have a series of pulsed light, intense pulsed light treatments that will make them peel off and go away.
What do you call chemical? What?
Chemical peels.
Chemical peels.
Yes.
Okay. Is that supposed to be not that big a process?
Correct. Yeah, these are not significant procedures that require downtime, but you can see dermatologists or plastic surgeons. Places
so
like that.
The insurance company probably not going to pay for it.
Generally not. So, but you should be a reasonable sort of price for doing something like that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So that would be considered to be a cosmetic
truly
procedure. And
truly.
Of course, you can have them on your hands, you can have them on your face, you can have
right.
them all different parts of the
right.
body.
Right. Yeah.
But these things are not likely to go on and become cancer or
correct.
Anything like that.
Correct.
So it's just if you don't like the appearance, you can do something about it. Otherwise,
c'est la vie.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right. To Sycamore, line number one up in northern Illinois. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I've been diagnosed with rosacea on the face, not the kind that swells your nose up big, but just a general itchy blotchiness, cheeks, forehead, mainly.
Right.
And I found over the years that a topical application of Elicon cream, which I believe is a steroid, certainly kept it in control very nicely, maybe once a week.
Right.
But I heard that that can lead to something called skin atrophy.
Right.
And what is that?
Right. Atrophy is thinning of the skin. It can lead to chronic broken blood vessels, too. And so I don't like using Elicon on faces because, when I'm lighthearted, which happens every couple of months, I call Elicon and the other cortisone creams in that strength, I call them boomerang creams because it will make the rash go away, but almost inevitably it will come back and whack you in the back of the head.
I see. Well, I have been given an antibiotic gel to put on it, which seems to be working very
sure.
nicely as well.
Right, the Metrogel or one of the others?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's a nice product that you can use long-term without atrophy. But atrophy refers to thinning of the outer layer of skin, thinning of the second layer of skin, and then the attendant broken blood vessels. You won't know who to blame, though, either, because that's also part of the normal rosacea process.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Well, it's a good idea to stop the application of Elicon, then.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
And there's no cure for this. I gather I'm stuck with it.
Yeah, you'd like to be optimistic, and the reality is there are people who get through this and don't have it as time goes on, but generally you often are looking at chronic treatment. But if it's a matter of putting on a topical antibiotic gel once a day, not such a bad price.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But I'm just wondering if I can stop it when I notice the symptoms have disappeared.
You know, if you get clear for a good enough while, it would be certainly sensible to stop and see how long it takes to come back. There's no harm in that. It's not as though, treating for 2 months and then seeing what happens with a month without treatment. That's not going to make it come back worse, or you won't have any greater price to pay.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes, I would like to ask a question about a product called Anthelios SX.
Oh, yes.
Which is not available everywhere and without a prescription, however. So what can you say about that as far as being a superior sunscreen?
It was available in Europe for quite a while. It was released sometime, I want to say, in January-ish, and in fact, I've got the name of that taped up on my cabinet because the name doesn't come right to my tip of my tongue every time I think about it. It's made by L'Oreal, and where you buy L'Oreal products, it should be available. Indeed, not prescription. And it's superior to most sunscreens in that it not only blocks out the ultraviolet B, which has that SPF grading scale, the sun-burning rays, it also blocks out all the ultraviolet A. And ultraviolet A is the wavelengths of light that cause drug reactions, chronic photoaging, and, those are the main things. So the ultraviolet A is a big dose of the ultraviolet light, and it's nice that it blocks it out. the availability is a little – I actually haven't tried to track it down because the Neutrogena people – and sorry, I don't own any stock in these companies, but that name comes up – have a competitor which is also a fabulous sunscreen, which also blocks out all the ultraviolet A, which is called Neutrogena Ultra Sheer. And it has some of this different ingredient that blocks out the A that's stabilized that will do the same thing. So rather than have my patients go on a sort of a wild goose chase looking for this L'Oreal product, I just say, if you can walk out into any of the stores in town here
and
pick up the Neutrogena product.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason to, I mean, the L'Oreal product is absolutely fabulous and really kind of a breakthrough, and so is the Neutrogena Ultra Sheer.
Well, no. The box that I bought it in said it comes from La Roche-Posay.
Yes, yes, that's the parent organization that owns L'Oreal.
Mm-hmm. And I do see that Walmart is advertising it now, as well as I know it's available in at Carl Clinic.
Excellent.
But the other question I'd like to ask is about rosacea.
Sure.
And what I'm curious about is the little seeds that keep popping up, little bumps, and each one of them has a little seed in it. Just a white or cream-colored seed.
Okay.
Just sort of solid.
Right.
Very tiny.
Right. That probably... Once again, radio disclaimer, that it probably is a little dry bit of the oil gland secretion that since it doesn't flow quite so well all the time, it gets dried out. So if you were to analyze it, it would probably have a little bit of keratin, the outer layer of skin, a little bit of cholesterol, a little bit of squalene, a little bit of some other components that the oil glands make. And sure enough, they come out of the little follicular orifices, the openings of the oil glands there.
And Metrogel doesn't seem to.
No. No, it's not. You're exactly right. It's not directed against that particular step of the process. There's another product called Finacea that is aimed towards that. And the Finacea is a nice product that also helps with the redness. I use them about 50-50, the Metrogel and the Finacea.
And how do you spell Finacea?
F-I-N. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Yeah, sometimes sounds like an S on the phone.
Yes.
F as in Frank, I-N-A-C-E-A. And it is a little bit of a keratolytic, which means it opens up little plugged up pores. Helps with the redness, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have an antibiotic. So the people who've got the little gooey, sort of more acne-looking rosacea generally do better with the Metrogel product. And the little plugged-up pores and the diffuse redness, they do a little bit better with the Finacea.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Just for a second to go back to sunscreen.
Yeah.
You would recommend that people look for one that will screen both UVA and B?
Well, yes. You know, I mean, I've got limited credibility in the world, so I try to use it where I most can get some benefit for the patient. So... if I can get people to use ultraviolet B sunscreen, not get sunburns, that's fabulous. Then if I've got people with the next level of interest, then I say, you know, you will really protect your skin of your face for sure longer, hands and arms too, where you do also block out the UVA. And that's where those other two products are really so superb. But if I, here's what I do. Mm-hmm. I use the A and B complete blocks on my face. And then when I'm going outside for my hands and my arms, I use one of the sprays because I'm in a hurry. I'm an American. So I put some of the spray sunscreens on that, you know, Bullfrog makes them and Banana Boat makes them. And they're sort of sport things and they don't sweat off so readily. They spread real fast. They're not a cream that will collect dust or whatever. So but if you're really conscientious and say, well, heavens, my skin's got to look very good over the next decade or two, well, then you pick one of those and you use it about everywhere.
Okay. But then it sounds as if that they're your choices. If you want something that's got protection of both against both A and B, you have fewer choices in terms of product.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You hit the issue there.
Because, and if that's important to you, you read the labels and look and see what it
says. Yeah. There are some other brands now, I want to say Coppertone's got them, with the stabilized UVA protection. That's going to be the gold standard over the next few years, and everybody else will, you know, they'll have to come out with a product because it's going to be the standard.
All right. Next, we have someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Would you say the name of the L'Oreal sunscreen again?
Sure. It's Anthelios, A-N-T-H-E-L-I-O-S.
E-L-I-O-S.
Yes.
Okay.
That's why I say Neutrogena Ultra Sheer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, we're kind of stuck on rosacea. I had never even heard of it until I have it.
Right.
And what's your opinion that it's really caused by mites?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, there are mites that live in our oil gland orifices, and we've known about this for quite a while. And we try not to stress it too much because it gets people a little bit creeped out.
I guess.
Yeah, you don't want to see them under the microscope. You'll never sleep again. It's just like the dust mites. You know, they look like something out of the Star Wars nightmare. One of the rare opportunities I've chosen to sit on the sidelines of opinion and say, well, maybe and maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people smarter than I have debated this since the 30s. And here's what I do, though. I treat with standard rosacea treatments, and if I get a nice response, I'm happy and we stop. But when I get resistant cases, I will sometimes use some of the medications that would kill and treat the mites.
Mm-hmm.
And I've occasionally had some significant response. So how's
but
that?
Only occasionally?
Only when pushed. You know, the issue has come up whether or not these play a role in acne, for goodness sake.
And whether you want to put that kind of stuff on your face.
What kind of stuff? The stuff that kills the mites?
Is that harmful?
No, it's what we use is pyrethrins now, which are extracted from marigolds.
Oh.
Yeah, same stuff that's in certain wasp and hornet sprays. But we use it to treat scabies, another mite, which is a definite, you know, mite-borne disease, skin disease. And just because we're on the radio and it's fun, that was the very first disease, scabies, which had the correct diagnosis, was puzzled out in 1638 by an Italian.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so they came up, you know, but otherwise before that we had the biles and the humors and all those other things. But he said, nope, little tiny critters that crawl on your skin and make you itch. And he got the right diagnosis and a treatment, immersing yourself in sulfur-containing spa water, drowned the little devils. So we had a right diagnosis and a cure.
Very good. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We continue. Next, we have someone on a cell phone. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm cell phone on the road, so I'm going to ask my questions and then hang up and listen offline.
Okay.
I have a question about Tinea versicolor.
Great.
This is something I've been for years and years, and sometimes it looks better, sometimes it looks worse. I'm wondering if it's possible to get rid of it for good. If so, how do I do that? And if not, what's the best way to live with it?
Excellent.
It's basically in the neck area.
Right.
And I guess that's it, and I'll listen offline.
All right. Thanks. Very good.
Okay, well, Tinea versicolor is a dimorphic yeast fungus that loves living on healthy human, young people kind of skin. It uses oil gland secretion material as its nutritional source, and typically people have it for years and years, and it can indeed be difficult to eliminate. You can certainly help it. And we've got a variety of choices. Let's see, in the interest of time, here's what I would suggest. If it's just on your neck, then I would treat it with a topical anti-yeast, antifungal cream, and all of them will treat this fairly significantly. So you can just sort of treat it till you're clear, and then twice a week, once a week, put on an application just to keep it at bay. I describe this inelegantly to my patients who have it, that it's much like having mildew in your shower stall. That you can get rid of it, but the environment is such that it loves to support it. So you're going to have to go back and treat it. I have people who have very widespread disease, basically neck to hips sorts of disease. We treat them with an oral antifungal pill called Nizoral. That's a brand name, but it's available generic also, N-I-Z-O-R-A-L. The pills, the shampoo isn't strong enough to make that go away. But you can take a 7 or 10 day course of that to get clear. And then for constant suppression, you take one pill the first and second day of the month for the next year, and it will suppress it and you can stay clear. So basically, you know, and why would you pick the first and second day? Because it's easier to remember than the fourth and the seventh. That's why.
Patient compliance. That's a,
right. Really, and that was somebody in Sweden or Finland figured that one out. He said, okay, so you can suppress it. Get it clear first. Two pills once a month, and it'll stay repressed for the year.
All right. Well, again, I hope that helps. And she wants to call up with a follow-up. We do have maybe about 5 minutes. Our guest is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. We're talking about skin care, and I know he'll do his best to help you out.
It's fine.
333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller's in Danville, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend for preventive after a possible exposure to poison ivy?
Very good. Poison ivy, right time of year for this issue to come up. First of all, I always have to do the whole thing. Number one, if I'd learn to identify the plant. So the smart thing to do would be to avoid it. Clothing, walk around, not through the poison ivy. There is also a product you can put on ahead of time if you know you're going to be in an environment where you might get exposed called Ivy Block. Non-prescription, again. And you put it on your skin, and it absorbs some of the oil to prevent it from getting on your skin. Then a quick shower afterwards will give you some time and some relief, and maybe if not completely prevent it, make it less severe. After you've been exposed, there's a relatively new product with good before and after pictures and some pretty good data, again, non-prescription, called Zanfel, Z-A-N-F-E-L. And they say that they can remove the oil, it can remove the oil from your skin, which I was taught isn't possible, but I've recommended to patients and they do pretty well. So your specific question was, what do you do after you've been exposed? I would have you wash with this product called Zanfel.
The problem with this is that it does have the toxin is in this oil, and you can get it on your skin, and then if you rub that part and then rub it someplace else, you can move it, or can't, or is
my,
that, that's
my
what
dogma,
it said.
My dogma says that that's not really what happens.
Okay.
That when it pops up different places, you've had various exposures, it got on your garden gloves and you touched your other places and transmitted it pre, because that fluid that seeps out is definitely not capable. That's your own serum.
Okay. So once that you've got it and you've got an outbreak, you can't take that and put it someplace.
That's what my dogma says, and I truly believe that.
Okay. So it sounds like you would recommend, well, certainly you would recommend if you know that you're going to go to some place where it is likely you might do what you can to keep covered so you don't get exposed.
Right. Yeah.
Otherwise, if you're going to be working outside and you even think that there's an outside chance, I suppose at the very least you'd say, well, you know, wear hand protection for one thing.
Sure.
And then watch out about, you know, other parts of skin that may get exposed to plant material.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've all got lots of interesting stories about poison ivy transmission place to place.
Yeah. And it probably, as you say, the bottom line is, you know, know what it looks like, because it's as actually as possible it could be in your yard and you would
absolutely
not know it.
Right. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, the plants start, the leaves start small, they get big. They, you know, the dried vines that are on your firewood that you bring in the wintertime, sure enough, they've got enough oil that you can get poison ivy in the wintertime.
Different times of the year, it looks very different.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a nice lady come in whose toddler had wobbled over to and walked over and dropped a little green berry in her palm. Because the toddler was just being a toddler. Mm-hmm. She said, guess what it was? It was a berry from a poison ivy plant.
Yeah. All right. We got a couple minutes at least. We'll try to get as many as we can still in the time remaining. Line 2, Urbana.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a question about polymorphic light eruption.
Excellent.
Which I have some years I do and some years I don't. And when I do have it, it almost spreads like hives, even on places that weren't directly, you know, out in the sun.
Okay.
And just any ideas about preventing it?
Sure.
Besides, I mean, I use sunscreen. Maybe I'll try the new Neutrogena Ultra Sheer or one of those. But
that might be, you know, that might be worth it because the A rays are probably the ones that are going to be, although it might even be visible light now mm-hmm. that I think about it. So a brief review of polymorphic light eruption. It's got a great name. And polymorphic means it can look like lots of things, and it can look like an ordinary little rash. It can be swollen and more deeply located in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it can look hive-like. Well, there's a separate thing called solar urticaria, which is true hives caused by the sun. Doesn't sound like that's what you've got. It sounds like you really do have PMLE, which is quicker to say. So the way we treat these is, well, the usual. Number one would be sun avoidance, but that's not as much fun as it might be. There are people who will treat you in an ultraviolet light box early in the spring or, you know, preceding the skin and very slowly increase because that will, as the expression is, harden your skin or get it used to a little bit of light and maybe diminish that. Because many people with your entity will end up later in the summertime not having any trouble. It's sort of an early, you know, early summer, late spring phenomenon. There's some evidence, not good statistical, that the more beta carotene you have on board as an antioxidant, the better you do. And it's intriguing that some summers you have this and some you don't. It might be interesting to, you know, look at carrot intake or other nutritional factors or general health issues that might have made it better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be more if it's really humid,
okay.
Hot, humid, as opposed to even the amount of sunlight.
Okay.
But then once they break out, besides the, I think, is it clobestiol?
Clobetasol, sure.
Clobetasol.
Right.
Is there anything else?
Well, not real. I mean, that's a very strong topical steroid, and if it works, that's nice as long as you don't overuse it. Certainly,
right.
Antihistamines to help with the itching,
mm-hmm.
either the Benadryl or the non-sedating sorts.
Mm-hmm.
No one's doing a lot of research on this in the laboratory.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. So we got at least one more. Lafayette, line one. Hello.
Hello. Are some people not at all susceptible to poison ivy?
Yes, there are people who simply have not developed an allergy to that to the compound there, and they will tell me that they're not allergic. And in like all other allergies, you get exposed, and eventually you get allergic to it or don't. Now, poison ivy is one of our most potent allergens we're aware of, so you can sensitize very many people to it, and the vast majority actually, probably in the high 90s. But there really are people who don't react to it. Rare, but they're there. The ones you feel bad for, the ones who say, I'm not allergic to poison ivy, and then go rolling down the hill, and then they find out that they have, in the meanwhile, become sensitized.
I come to the program late. Have you mentioned removing moles?
No.
I note that my dermatologist does it with freezing.
Sure.
Could I do that myself with the freeze-off stuff from Dr. Scholl's?
You know, I wouldn't recommend it for about 50 reasons. because the isobutane that's in those home freezing things really isn't nearly as cold as the liquid nitrogen that your physician would use. And it's also intensely flammable. And it's hard to really lay on the lumber hard enough with the Dr. Scholl's home spray kits to really effectively remove anything.
Well, a pharmacist also warned me against it.
Yeah. He's being sensible.
Yeah, the box itself doesn't say.
I'm surprised.
Well, it may inside. I didn't open. Okay, thanks
all
very
right, thanks.
Much.
Is that the same stuff that you put in butane lighters?
Well, I don't know. I think I don't know the actual chemical. I mean, butane has got, you know, four carbons and, you know, how many, six, eight, ten hydrogens on it. And it's isobutane is just sort of rearranged.
I guess I missed that day in chem class.
Wow. I think the FDA missed the approval process, actually, when they let that one go out.
Well, I was wondering about that, actually, because I think just for I saw a commercial for it just the other day for the first time for that very product, and I was kind of wondering, well, is that, you know. So you'd say, you'd suggest people not mess with that.
Just make sure you're not smoking when you use it.
All right. And I suppose that you would also like the opportunity to say to people, don't go to the tanning salon.
Oh, please, no, don't, and I try to cajole. I try to be serious. Obviously, there are more dangerous things to do in the world than to get in on a tanning bed, but it's certainly an avoidable sort of things, and people can look great without a tan.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we better leave it right at that. I'm sorry. We have one caller we cannot take. Yeah. Dr. Lester Farner, he's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. Thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me. I love it.